Whoa. Paige, I hope we're like similar to the same height because I just lowered the mic. So, Paige and I first met this past summer. Well, we really didn't start getting to know each other until about the 5th century in Anglo-Saxon England last semester. Two poets displaced, removed from everything they knew, except for the poetry they'd find at the end, Paige and I were forced to fend for ourselves and for each other in a strange land with an old language. Needless to say, this experience amounted to a great deal of stress. In one episode of our adventures, I watched Paige silently but intently and powerfully study for an upcoming trial, quiz, with a stack of note cards, only to find myself laughing uncontrollably at their resolve to even bother in the first place. Paige, realizing my easy, overzealous laughter was stress-induced, simply said, "Dustin, I think we just handle stress differently." And they were right. That difference became key in what I admire in Paige's work. Even in the most tedious or perhaps menacing of situations, there remains a childlike innocence in Paige's writing, a marveling at the animations of nature, both big and small, a puddle, an ocean, a bed of oysters, an eggshell. Things often considered granted or mundane in adulthood. To cite specifically, I recall one of Paige's poems in which a speaker and the speaker's brother were catching tadpoles. The speaker expressed remorse for those caught by the brother, who ate them. "If you just let me catch you, I'd let you go," the speaker says in response to the incident, with a sense of genuine remorse for the missed opportunity and the fate of the tadpoles. Paige's poems often deal with a speaker who conveys a muted intensity over the entire spectrum of human emotion in the quest to find an identification that liberates the self rather than confines it to rigid shapes or too tiny of spaces. Such a navigation results in a compelling mixture of tension, tenderness, and angst, a combination that betrays a fear of stasis with regard to one's identity over everything else I've cited. But all that thrown against the wall, the fact remains that Paige's accomplishments speak for themselves. You should know that Paige Lewis is the author of the chapbook Reasons to Wake You, winner of the Florida Review's 2016 Editor's Award in Poetry. Their poems have appeared or are forthcoming in Poetry, American Poetry Review, Plowshares, Best New Poets 2017, The Massachusetts Review, The Georgia Review, The Iowa Review, Poetry Northwest, Ninth Letter, and elsewhere. Paige currently serves as the assistant editor at Dive Dapper, a doctoral student in Florida State University's English and Creative Writing program. They live and teach in Tallahassee, Florida, with the rest of us. I'm honored to introduce you, Paige. Welcome.
From up here. It's like you got ready for Valentine's Day a day early, maybe? No? So thank you all for being here, and thank you, Dustin, for that. That was awesome, and I do not handle stress as well as you handle stress. Can y'all hear me? We good? Cool. Gonna break this. But thanks for being here. And I know it's not exactly Valentine's Day, but I'm going to celebrate today as if it was. And so every poem that I'm going to read is somehow a love poem. And if you can't tell, I'll explain it afterwards what the love is for, which means that some of these poems aren't love poems and I just want to read them. So I'm going to start. I don't think I have to explain any of this. Okay. This poem's called Where I'm From, Every House is a House with an Obstructed View. Where I'm from, every house is a house with an obstructed view of the ocean. Oh, we are boring and superstitious in our city. We believe tides are caused by millions of oysters gasping in unison. Our rooms are eggshell white, and our eggshells are poked through with silver spoons to let the demons out. Yes, we fall in love, but our love isn't golden so much as it is Midas light, hard and cheap. Everything it touches turns green. We run out of swoon quickly and respect the loveless who are paid to stand naked in department store windows, eating homemade granola and sketching caricatures of anyone who stops to stare. Yesterday, I gawked at a man who wore a yellow knit cap on his penis. I was impressed by how acutely aware he made me of my forehead, which took up more than half of the portrait. I tipped him generously with one hand and gave myself bangs with the other. As a child, I was just as impatient and always justly punished. When I tore the buds open in my garden, I lost my garden. When I threw rocks into tree branches to shake fruits loose, gravity was ruthless. These new bangs do a marvelous job hiding the scars, but I still miss the flowers. Where I'm from, we are practical and ready to grow our mistakes. We whisper our heaviest secrets into seed packets and launch them toward the nearest planet where they'll take root in neat rows. Flower, fruit, flower, fruit. This is how we build our new home. How we make ourselves light enough for space flight. When I arrive, it will be easy to find which orchard is mine. Thanks. That was a poem about my love for yellow knit caps. And so this next poem, so does everyone know Glenn Gould? He's like a famous Canadian pianist. That's all you need to know about him. This poem is called You Be You and I'll Be Busy. You be you and I'll be busy chewing five sticks of juicy fruit, turning my jaw into a clicking, pain-pricked mess and reaching for another pack. Because hard work is defined by a body's wreckage, and I'm hard at work writing my presidential acceptance speech. A dartboard in every garage, a prison sentence for anyone caught explaining magic. You be me, and I'll be the man leaning against your fence, expecting compliments on my new haircut. Now, be you and take this personality quiz. Do you scrape your fork against your teeth? Results are in. You're the kind of person who has to stop doing that. You be you, and I'll be racing across the yard, trying to catch robins to prove how tender I am with tender things. I'll be Glenn Gould, hunched and humming at your piano until it suddenly springs a leak, the notes too full to hold themselves together. I'll be me again when I open the windows to keep our apartment from flooding. Don't be the woman on the sidewalk below, drenched and furious. Instead, take a turn as Gould, an older Gould. Wear gloves indoors. Tell me you can't have lovers for fear of harming your elegant hands. Clamor about the bed, being the man who always almost touches me. Then become the man who does. So this next poem, have y'all ever been to like a rock store, and not like a music store, because I don't think those exist anymore, but like gem stores where you can find like amethysts and Dalmatian jasper and stuff like that. We've got one in Tallahassee in the mall. I really, really love these stores, and I will go into them every like time I pass one, and I will never really buy anything because I'll wander around for like an hour and I'll pick up every single like stone that I can, and then I'll like flip it and see the price and I'll be like, ooh, no, I'm not gonna pay $16 for this tiny little thing. But I still really enjoy like the atmosphere. And so this poem is, this is kind of like a love poem to that store, but also just a love poem. And it's dedicated to Jamie Ringleb. Last night I dreamed I made myself your paperweight. This seems wrong. Seems like a sign that I need to spend more time on my own. So I call my friend and drive him to the store full of overpriced healing stones. I want the women shopping to know I'm not with my friend. I want them to know how great I'm doing with my adventures and independence. I'm ready to shout, look at my healthy new life. But my friend thinks it's a bad idea to frighten people in a place with so many hard throwables. Would they hurt me? These women look as if they'd smell like pink magnolias and violin rosin if I got close enough, but I won't. I'm too busy searching for the stone that best represents me. It's not the blue one specked with god bits or the ear-shaped obsidian. It's not anything polished. And I think about how hard it is for me to believe in the first Adam, because if Adam had the power to name everything, everything would be named Adam. Then I think, that's a pretty smart thought. I don't say it to my friend. I don't say it to the magnolia women. Do they still count, these hours I've spent on my own? Do they still count if I'm saving all of my shiniest thoughts for you? So this next poem, it's another love poem, but it starts as a hate poem. I don't know if any of you, like, when you discovered that, like, Thomas Edison was kind of an asshole, like, you're like, oh, that sucks because he did some cool stuff. That's how I feel about Pavlov. And so this poem kind of starts as a hate poem towards Pavlov, who was not nice to his dogs at all. And it's called Pavlov Was the Son of a Priest. Pavlov was the son of a priest, which is a biographical fact only ever stated when discussing a man of either unrivaled righteousness or extreme wickedness. Imagine this. He never once used a bell in his saliva experiments, unless you count the plink of kibble falling from his dog's surgically open throats. And why would you want to count that? I admit, I often tell you about the cruelties of others to stifle the growling in my own troubled core. I sense something is about to happen, though I can't tell you what, because last night, after I prophesied that a man would steal the Smithsonian's rare and hideous pumpkin diamonds, I had no fun at all crouching behind the museum's display cases until the night guard carried us out by our ears. She told you, treat your mouth less like a garbage chute. She told me, forget what you think you know about space. But I only really know about its violence. I forget that the moon smells like spent gunpowder. I forget what would happen to your body in a black hole. I don't forget your body. This would be unforgivable. And I have so many strikes against me already. I'm sorry, I couldn't hide my joy when you said lonely. It made me feel useful. I used to be aimless, swallowing marbles and clicking my way through cities, licking my thumbs to smooth the eyebrows of almost any man. Now, I demand a love that is stupid and beautiful, like a pilot turning off her engines mid-flight to listen for rain on wings. I want to find you a peach so ripe that only your breath would bruise it. I want to press its velvet heat against your cheek make you edge into the bite until your mouth is too wet to ask questions. If something happens, let it. I admit I couldn't hear the thief's footsteps over the museum's alarm, but I'm certain that if the diamonds jostling against ugly diamonds in his drawstring bag sounded like anything, they sounded like ringing. Thanks. Cool. So I have two more. This next poem, sometimes I like to think about what it would be like if I was king, like not just for a day, but just forever. And so this poem is what that would look like. It's called Royal Eye. My specific heart, know that I am king here. I have my sword, my seat, and my passions pinned to the royal bulletin board for all to see. I'm a kind king. No skinks ever shed his blue tail in fear of me. I perform my tasks bravely. Just yesterday, I sewed the flappy lakes into place without thimble or worry of prick. I've granted everyone the freedom to eat dinner in bed, and I've rid the realm of rats by reading their tiny diaries out loud until they ran into the forests, red-cheeked and babbling. I'm understandably busy, so if I decide I no longer have time or want for children, I expect an "all right, your brightness," and for you to stop building our miniatures out of pipe cleaners and meltwater. I'm kind. I'm making love easy for everyone. It feels exactly as the movies proclaimed. As king, it's my duty to be one with the universe, but I hate how the galaxies hover over me, expecting mistakes. And, my love, I might make a few. It's essential for me to trust, to tell you that if I lose my calm, if there comes a day where I walk into a room and everyone finds a corner to hide in, I'll need you to be ready to dethorn the throne. My weaknesses are many and stubborn. If you must strike, do so at night, when I'm outside and alone and looking up. Thanks, y'all. This is my last poem. Thanks so much for being here. I'm really excited to get to go first so that I can be like calm and actually like listen to what Sean is gonna have to say. And I'm really, really excited about that. But if you need any more love tips about caps or anything like that, I will be happy to talk to you about that afterwards. This poem is called "The Moment I Saw a Pelican Devour." The moment I saw a pelican devour a seagull, wings swallowing wings, I learned that a miracle is anything that God forgot to forbid. So when you tell me that saints are splintered into bone bits smaller than the freckles on your wrist, and that each speck is sold to the rich, I know to marvel at this, and not the fact that these same saints are still wholly intact and fresh-faced in their plexiglass tomb displays. We holy our own fragments when we can. Trepanation patients wear their skull spirals as amulets. Mothers frame the dried foreskin of their firstborn. And I've seen you swirl my name on your tongue like a thirst pebble. Still, I try to hold on to nothing for fear of being crushed by what can be taken, because sometimes not even our mouths belong to us. Listen. In the early 1920s, women were paid to paint radium onto watch dials so that men wouldn't have to ask the time in dark alleys. They were told it was safe, told to lick their brushes into sharp points. These women painted their nails, their faces, and judged whose skin shined brightest. They coated their teeth so their boyfriends could see their bites with the lights turned down. The miracle here is not that these women swallowed light. It's that when their skin dissolved and their jaws fell off, the Radium Corporation claimed they all died from syphilis. It's that you're telling me about the dull slivers of dead saints while these women are glowing beneath our feet. Thank you.